Well, we're few in number, but the quality that makes up for the quantity. And also, these seminars and lectures get put up on the website, and we get lots of downloads from those seminars and lectures as well. So, this is the first of our graduate seminars for this term. These seminars are an opportunity for graduate students to share their research with us. And I'm very pleased indeed to introduce, forgive me if I pronounce your name wrong, Pulani Lizzie Motswapong, who's doing a PhD at Christ Church Canterbury on Indian marriage system.
Yep.
And within anthropology, I imagine.
Yes.
Is it the anthropology department? And she's going to give us a talk today entitled A Super Gift or a Conduit, The Place of a Daughter in the Indian Marriage Exchange. So, over to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor. Yeah. Actually, my PhD is on marriage gifts in India. So what I'm trying to do is looking at how gifts were exchanged in ancient India using the classical texts, and then moving on to modern India and how the woman, because she's the one who's the main object of exchange there, how gradually she moves on from her status, like from what she was in the past to what she is now. And because modern India, for instance, is characterized by dowry, then my focus was on dowry. So my title of the paper is Exchange Marriage. Marriage Dana in Ancient and Modern India, Focus on Hindu Dahej, which is Hindu dowry. Yeah. First of all, let me, I'll just go through the abstract just to clarify a few things. In ancient Hindu lawgivers have always viewed spiritual merit as arising from the spirit of Dana. Marriage Dana, especially Kanya Dana, has been considered as such. In the same way, the father, by giving away his daughter, was assured of spiritual merit. In ancient India, the daughter was designated as the super gift, and all the other gifts that were accompanying her were regarded as secondary. Similarly, marriage continues to form an integral part in modern Indian system in the form of dowry, marriage gifts of them. The daughter continues to be given away, but her role is subsumed by the property she carries with her to her marital family. As a result, I argue that she is more or less like reduced to a vehicle or a conduit. The shift in status of the daughter as a super gift, that is in the past, to a vehicle now, has closely affected and significantly affected the status of women in contemporary Indian society in the form of dowry. The practice has spread all over India, and its wider ramifications are visible in the cases of bride burning, suicides, harassment. So this paper, what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to compare and contrast the role of the daughter in the exchange while I take into account the factors that may have contributed to the shift of a super gift to a conduit. In my introduction, I'll start by defining Dana, which is my main focus of my PhD paper. And I say there are two types of Dana, which is the material gift and the spiritual gift, which is Amisadana and Dharmadana. In ancient India, whatever gifts the daughter carried with her were regarded as secondary, because her, like the daughter, was designated as the super gift or important gift. Therefore, Kanyadana was designated as Dharmadana, hence highly regarded during the marriage negotiations. when the father was giving the daughter, he was strictly forbidden to accept any form of cash or anything in ancient India, and any acceptance was or could have been interpreted as a sale of the daughter, hence shulka or bride price, which was not acceptable, especially during the ancient Indian lawgiver's time. The Hindu ideal dictates that a daughter should be presented as a kanyadna by her father to a man who is learned in scriptures. And that's in Manu. And this shows that the girl's father recognizes the superior status of the bridegroom. So the gift of virgin, therefore, was socially exalted and was very central as a religious sacrament. Furthermore, the father, by giving away his daughter in marriage, was fulfilling his religious obligation, also his dharma, by thus aiming for a religious merit or punya. In the same way, the receiver of the religious motivated gift was given nothing in return except the merit, in case this was the priest. And it was not just any other priest, it was a priest who was in performance, who was performing the duty, especially in the daiva marriage. So dana in ancient India, as a result, was regarded as very symbolic. And it was given as a sign of affection for religious and spiritual merit. Whereas in modern India, it has more evolved to mean gaining social prestige as well as status. And as a result of this, dowry has become institutionalized and very, very rigid. However, there is no denial that dana and dakshina, in a way, may have contributed to the shift in the meaning of modern dowry. But the problem lies with the overshadowing of the daughter or the bride by her property. There are a number of aspects involved, for instance, suddenly rendering love and affection to become a status quo, and especially to the bride's family. However, these modern gifts, they fail to demonstrate why it was imperative for a bride to participate in ritual of gift-giving at the time of marriage. That is why she'll ask, what's so special about gift-giving at the time of marriage when there are so many gifts that are given during other performances of the samskaras, like birth, and why so special, why this one so special? And looking at the transfer, are we saying the transfer is permanent or temporary or both? The decisive factor is ascertaining whether modern dowry represents permanent transfer of assets from the woman to the man's family. This relates to the issue of permanent versus temporary control of marriage property, especially by the bride. This control, I argue, is mainly from the boy's side, because once the gifts leave the girl's family cease to have any power. In this case, the transfer of marriage property becomes permanent, but it's not mostly for the girl, it's for the other family. And this aspect is later misinterpreted in modern India to mean that the takers of the bride are not supposed to give, but always to receive. So dowry gifts in modern India disregard the notion of religious merit, which was very crucial in the past. Even though it is believed that there's a share of salvation and immortality is given in return, since they have received the gift, the exchange is very unbalanced. Even though it appears to be the act of giving and ruining the family of the bride, people still give out the gifts anyway, because it is believed that they imply more enrichment in the spiritual sense, not the material sense. That's from Makayas. Modern Indian Amisadana tends to be more or most important aspect of the exchange, while the daughter is just transporter. This weight is given to the presence that the girl brings, rendering her role as secondary and almost non-existent. In fact, she's more or less treated as a vehicle. And with the deteriorating status of the bride, it has become very easy to read this bride's or the gifts of the daughter as dowry matters. And this are normally known as kitchen fires, and because of the setting, but there are many ways that can be used to get rid of the daughter if the in-laws maybe feel that they are not satisfied with the gift. And in most cases, this paves a way for arranging yet another marriage for the widow and accumulating yet another dowry, which means another woman is bringing more presents or gifts. There's always been a rationale behind giving presents of by parents especially, because these presents in the past were viewed as gifts of affection, and they were mainly given by the family, like the brothers, the mother, and all, and the relatives. And that's why dowry has always been there. But the only problem with the Indian one is the uniqueness, where the woman is somewhere along the lines, her status is becomes questionable just because of what she brings. Generally, a gift should be it should entail reciprocation, but modern dowry fails to acknowledge that. And I quote Moss when he says, even though all the gifts in theory may be viewed as voluntary, disinterested, and spontaneous, they are in fact obligatory and interested, because they are always expected, even if there is no open mentioning of them during the discussions or during the marriage negotiations in modern India. So what happens is the takers, they assume that the givers will ultimately give. It's assumed. Hence, that's why they, in the first place, they choose them as their in-laws, because there will be many adverts placed, and they choose that because they assume that the daughter's family will have the capacity to give. What happens then, at the end of the day, the young bride becomes a device for extorting more and more dowry as and when the situation demands. It just depends when something comes up, then they would like maybe to get more. Even when it is not explicitly demanded, it is implicit in the customs and traditions of the community. And depending on the specific situation, dowry involves an ongoing financial obligation on the part of the woman's family, and this comes in periodic payments of cash, goods, and it may go for years. It's like it may go for a lifetime. And because of that, dowry demands are becoming more like predatory, and they have escalated. In fact, Kumari feels that they are the most, they are the highest killer of women than any other thing. And the flow of gifts, like I say, begins from the engagement ceremony, and it goes on maybe when a child is born, when the woman goes back to her mother's place, when she comes back, when the child is named. All those can be used to ask the woman to bring more. And at times, even when the second baby is born, the same cycle tends to renew itself with a great momentum. But I have to point out that we shouldn't associate dowry with Hindu society, because that's what many scholars have done in the past and even now, because the problem is an Indian community problem, because even the Muslims, they practice it. Sikhs, Jains, everybody practice it, and it does not matter about whether someone from the high caste or low caste, it's all done. So I propose that it is wrong to associate dowry with Hindu society. That's why even if my PhD paper is Hindu Dahej, so far I've looked into the papers and all the classical texts, and I've seen no evidence that links more than dowry to ancient India. So that's why I have to mention that here. And one other thing I want to point out is like the property, when it comes, it's mainly taken over by the family, but the wife, especially the mother-in-law, is mainly in charge of the household things, and the main things like property, land, is the man. So at the end of the day, everybody is involved in the gift. Mm. It's not only the women, or it's not only the men. Everybody becomes involved. That's why at the end of the day, I argue that women, they become both the victims and the perpetrators of the dowry, even if at the beginning, like I said, there were more the special, there was super gifts. But now, as time goes on, they become caught in between. And I'll explain later why I feel they're both the victims and as well as the perpetrators. But all in all, the senior women are the ones who control, like I say, in the household, and the males, they control and the a big property like land. And one other thing that is very interesting and that I need to point out is the gift, whether what happens when the owner, who's supposed to be the owner, dies or when she divorces. According to the ancient scripts, when someone dies or the daughter dies, then that property should be distributed amongst her heirs as well as the daughters who are remaining behind. And in case of divorce, which is in modern India very rare, because it is viewed as a woman who divorces is stigmatized, and she's viewed as a deserter because she brings shame and into the family. So there's a problem or a question of honor and shame. That's why it's very difficult for a woman to just leave. So, but in case of divorce, still, according to the modern law, a woman should also be given her share if she leaves the house. And most women, however, do not normally take their share, and they prefer to sit and stay in the marriage because they are expected to adjust, which is normal for any marriage. The first years, we've been told, it will get better, so just take time, it will be okay. So in that way, I come up with this small term called a silent courage. So they have to display that silent courage, and in so doing, gradually, they are accepted into the folds of the new home, and as a result, they are viewed as the patibrata, like ideal woman. But if she decides like the following day to quit, then she is shunned by the same community that had elevated her to the perfect woman or wife of wifehood. And at the end of the day, the women who quit, they usually take refuge in places like Saheli. It's like an organization that is concerned about women who are abused and who have left their homes, trying to reconcile them with their marital families. Considering modern India, for instance, there's a problem when we come to define already existing movable and immovable properties, because this is where the big chunk of the property is. But the acceptance must be made during the lifetime of the donor, when she's still there, and while he's capable of giving. However, in cases where the donee dies before accepting the gift, then it should be deemed void, shouldn't be taken. And the gift, whether it's immovable and or movable, should be effected by a registered instrument and signed by two witnesses. But then I argue that in most cases, especially in the rural areas, most women are not literate, and this law seems not to apply to them because they cannot sign the papers. So it's more favorable for women in the city. And I argue that in practice, the law is far from being followed, and it is obvious that the gifts still go on endlessly, and the daughter becomes alienated from it and does not become part of the registration or the signatures during the exchange, if any, is carried out. And although the groom's quality also used to play an important role in modern India, this are indifferent to caste. In fact, in modern India, what is more emphasized is the profession of the groom takes more precedence over his caste. The caste is still there, but what the groom does is more important. For instance, doctors and IT professionals, well, they catch, they have the highest catch. And teachers, yeah, so. So what I'm trying to say is education of the prospective groom now is the main important aspect, because the parents want to be sure of the girl's status. Like when she gets into the family now and also her future, they have to be sure that she's she'll be taken care of. And especially when we look into this new Indian economy, which is where gain or prestige comes through expenditure rather than through saving. So it is the gift that is characterized by strong competitive spirit. So there's that competition. That's why even before the marriage, some communities will display all the dahej, every present that has been given to the girl, and taking, she'll take with her, and all the neighbors in the community will be called to come and see dahej, to see the display. And everybody is allowed to comment on that. It's just, it's natural, it's nothing wrong with that. Then talking about merit, if at all giving is so meritorious, why then is the groom's family not participating in the ritual? I argue that as much as the bride's family needs merit, the groom's family needs it too. Therefore, to claim that the shift from bride price to dowry has anything to do with the desire for gift giving, which is affectionate and enhance the social status, needs to be re-evaluated, because according to me, it leaves so much to be desired. This is because even bride price, it served the same purpose, that is, it was a token of love and appreciation. For instance, in my culture, we do the bride price, and the daughter is supposed to be given something by the family that marries her, because the family, her family feels that they are losing out someone who used to be a very important part of their life, not only their life, but also helping in the fields, you know, extra labor. So that's why it has to be given. And to complete the gift, there must be a transfer, and there should be, you know, apparent evidence of ownership from who is the donor and who is the donee. And I argue that these gifts should be revocable, and there shouldn't be there should be conditions, and it should not be coerced, or there shouldn't be any fraud or undue influence. It should be given voluntarily, as that what is what dowry is defined as, voluntary gifts. And despite all these laws outlining the validity and invalidity of the gifts, the opposite is the truth, because in reality the gifts are coerced, and even in cases where the gifts were registered, most brides still live empty-handed and dispossessed from their in-laws, if anything happens to them, if they divorce or if they are thrown out of the house. So I'm asking, what lends modern dowry its authenticity, and why is it so vital for the bridegroom family to gain its own standing by marrying their son to a daughter of superior family? Why do hypergamous marriages involve question of status only for the bride's family, and why can't a man marry up? These are just questions that I'm throwing out. Does it mean it result in the bridegroom to gain its own prestige by marrying their sons or daughters to a superior family? Some just questions I'm throwing to the floor. And if ownership of marital property is defined ambiguously, or if the property is given as marriage payment, then it should represent a permanent transfer of assets also, not only to a man's family, also to a woman's family. Because in modern India, women are now working and they're also earning money and bringing lots of income into the family. So it's no longer the housemakers as it used to be in the past. So are we saying that daughters are empowered or disempowered by dowry? In order to understand how dowry empowers women, I think we should explain it in the context of sridhana. That is the only property that women were given over the centuries by their natal families. However, women's property should not be confused. This sridhana should not be confused with dowry or dahej, because they are two different things. In addition, one has to compare the status of the daughter to those of their brothers or siblings in property distribution and division. As it is common with marriage, the daughter leaves her natal home to join her marital family. And upon leaving her natal home, she was presented with her property, with her sridhana. The nature and character of sridhana as it is now is a far cry from present day dowry. These gifts in ancient India were made before the fire, and which was taken as a witness according to Katyayana. They were made at the bridal procession, they were made as a token of love, and they were given by the family. And the woman, this is the most interesting part, had absolute power over her property and could deal with it in any manner she chose. And furthermore, she could spend it either part or whole to give it away or at her own pleasure without consulting the husband. In fact, the husband had no say in the gifts, unless, of course, in cases of famine, but he was still morally obliged to restore the gifts when the famine was over. So it would be far-fetched to claim that property which is transferred at a woman's marriage is premortem inheritance, or it constitutes her female rights to property, because there's a lot of inequality and discrepancy regarding the share between the sons and the daughters. The new law now has come, where has been built, where now the girl has the same share, should be given the same share as the boys, but still in practice is not the same. The property connotes that it belongs to the bride by being her sridhana, but there is no clarity as to whether the recipient of the payment is the bridegroom himself, or is his family, or is the daughter. In spite of these inconsistencies, women in modern India would rather have dowry given nonetheless. In giving dowry, women hope to assert their position in the marital household as a bargaining tool with their husbands and in-laws. And I quote Leslie, due to the cultural constraints encountered by these women, they become party to dowry exchange because they see themselves not as victims, but as driving force of daughters and mothers whose interests lie in creating their own individuality. That's Leslie, 91, page 1. It is true that these women may be striving to create their own identity and status in their new household because of the amount of dowry she brought. However, in practice, it is not a daughter's portion, since it is alienated from her, is basically in the hands of the bridegroom's family. In order to substantiate this, I quote Sirohi, 2003, quoting Shashi, who is a new bride whose marriage gifts had been confiscated by Shubash, his groom's family, from day one. She states, the kitchen utensils were kept aside to be used for his sister's dowries. Only the refrigerator was being used by the family. Shashi had no control over her jewelry either. It had been taken away from her for safekeeping when she first arrived at her house of in-law's house. Shirohi, 2003, page 67. Many brides share the plight of Shashi. This is a clear indication that dowry disempowers women. It is further intensified by the perception that a girl child is an economic burden, resulting in the spiraling of daughter nun preference. It is more or less a test of value for women because it commodifies and dispenses women regardless of caste, class, or religion. When considering dowry in its present coercive, extravagant form, it is highly unlikely it enhances a woman's status or strengthens her bargaining power. And taking into account the reinforcing image that women are an economic burden, the dependent status as well as practice only maintain and reproduce the devaluation of women. In reality, most women are excluded from ownership, control, and decision-making on productive resources as well as socio-cultural and religious taboos. These sanctions further sustain the devaluation of women and underline their dependency and their inferior status. Dowry as female property is contingent upon a woman's marriage that draws from and reinforces her dependency. Although in theory dowry may be seen as empowering, in practice, it is not a woman's right to demand or to determine the amount of dowry to be exchanged. In addition to that, it is not always an equal share of the family property because the sons always get a larger proportion. Finally, it is not necessarily under a woman's control, let alone her possession, for it is her marital family that is in control. And should a woman be ill-treated, abandoned, or widowed, there's little chance of her being able to reclaim any of the things she was given as her street dowry. In conclusion, what am I saying? Is a woman a super gift or a conduit, or is she both? So where do we place the daughter in Indian marriage? Is she a super gift, a conduit, or both? From my discussion, I draw the conclusion that the daughter is both a super gift and a conduit. The former was more prevalent in ancient India, where the daughter was exchanged as a primary concern or primary source, and due to the fact that the family, especially the father, was assured of merit on giving her, especially giving her on time, that is, as soon as she got her periods or menses. However, this cannot be said of modern India because her property subsumes her position. Of course, she still plays a major role because without her, there can be no exchange, thus still remaining her status as of super gift. However, her role is more of a conduit, I argue, than a super gift, because parents of a girl, do want to settle her in a family that guarantees her security, not just at the beginning of the marriage, but for a lifetime. And this comes with a price. It means they have to pay more dowry. In order to guarantee her comfort in her marital home, parents have to give to impress. And in addition to that, the conjugal family also chooses a particular family on the assumption that the bride's family has the capacity to give. And so what are the end results? Giving away the daughter becomes equated with selling the goods at a market where the highest bidder get the products. Finally, it is very unlikely that the daughters rightfully claim her position and which is of a super gift in an Indian marriage. This is because most families, even wives' families, are at some point givers of dowry. To see all givers giver families as victims of dowry enables parents of girls to indulge in self-pity and decry dowry, but when it is their turn to give, without acknowledging the benefits they derive from it, then they receive it. So it's very difficult to say the givers, to blame the givers or the takers, because at one point in time, everybody is a giver and a taker. Let me conclude by saying the position of the daughter has been explicitly expressed by Archana Lakara in her poem Marriage Market, and it reads, "We are the commodities, furniture on sale, some elegant made of ebony, intricately carved, others plain, bare, not polished, standing, waiting, endlessly, reluctantly, bidding our time for the right bidder, to be sold by the very hands that kept us, to our customers at the bargain, our future to decorate someone else's house." In brief, let me say the tone of this poem is melancholic. It is an outcry made by a daughter, or a Kanya, or bride-to-be, who likens herself to a piece of furniture that is put on display to be sold to the highest bidder. This would be, for instance, an IT professional or a doctor or anybody who's perfect job. Some of these women, according to the poem, are very beautiful and mature, while others are still young and not fully matured. But I argue it doesn't really matter whether they're mature, because still none of them has a say in the amount of dowry that is exchanged. And it is true, the wait for the highest bidder and the right bidder seems to be the most painful and longest. And in most cases, it seems to go forever. But it is the father's responsibility to make sure that he gives the daughter away, even in modern India. And lastly but not least, it's worth quoting the last piece where she says, "It is the very hands that care for us, that give us to our customers," which means the family, her family, or the family of the daughter, is the one that sells, in a way, it's like selling them to the customer who has the highest points. And what is their duty? It is mainly to decorate or to go to someone else's house, and that someone else's house is none other than the marital house. That's it for today.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Where did it all go wrong? Because I've actually known a lot of Indian ladies who've been in arranged marriages and have been very happy actually.
Yeah.
And you'd feel that actually, when I've got children in their early 20s and seeing what they're doing, I think, well, wouldn't arranged marriages be a wonderful idea? You know, because where you know what you're going to, and I've known people in arranged marriages, I'd say for the most part, who've been very happy, and very few are not, though I have known ones who haven't. So where did it all go wrong? Because I sort of feel that something must have gone wrong in perhaps the last century or so. Is this right? That at some point the system must have worked quite well, the payoff between generations, that, okay, so it's a drag when you first go as a daughter-in-law, but then you get to be the mother-in-law. You know, there's kind of a payoff each way along. And something must have gone wrong somewhere, that it's now with all the bride burnings and things, because this I don't think was happened in the past, did it?
No, it didn't.
So what's happened in the last 100 years or so that's made it?
Yes, in fact, that's what my PhD is trying to find out.
Yes,
like what went wrong?
Yeah,
for whatever was good to be all of a sudden turned into this horrific, custom. Because it's not, like I say, it's not a Hindu custom. I'm arguing that it's not a Hindu custom.
The arranged marriage, or
no,
or
the dowry
custom.
Dowry custom.
Do you think the dowry has actually made the marriage system go wrong? Do you think the introduction of diaries?
Yeah, I mean, marriage is very is one of the most important samskaras in Hindu culture, and as long as there's marriage, there's a gift, and in the present form as it is now, it's very difficult for women to get out of it or to do anything about it because they still want, they have to be married. So some scholars say in the last 50 years, they say in the last 50 years, but I argue that it's got nothing to do with the 50 years. I think it goes even further than
I would like to ask, when you say ancient period,
yes,
so
I'm using,
where do you start that ancient period? Which text? Or
What I'm doing is I'm using throughout the Vedas to the...
But did you find any reference to dowry or to dana of a girl in the Vedas? I have never come across.
No, that's what I'm trying to...
Yeah.
That's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to look, go back and search like everything that comes with
because
dana.
For the past 35 years, I have been doing a little bit of study of the Vedas.
I have come across
about the dana of a kanya or of dowry, that's
true.
For that matter.
Even the women were
in
free
Vedic
to
period.
Yeah, even the women were free to choose their own husbands and all that.
So it's only with the Smriti period or the Dharma Shastra period that the decline in the society, Hindu society, I'm talking only of Hindu society, that starts. But there also we have 8 types of
marriages
you must have.
Yes.
So not all these marriages include this dowry giving or this type of...
In fact, even all the marriages, none of them include any dowry.
Yeah.
But
oh,
there's one...
Dowry is mentioned.
It's not mentioned.
In the 8 types
in fact,
of...
No,
it's shulka, which is mentioned. Like,
oh, they do mention them in
the shulka. Price,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
And as she says, because I was just listening to your paper, you have done a lot of research and whatever academically, but I don't know, as a Hindu woman, 3 generations I have seen myself, my grandmother, my mother, and now myself, and I have 2 daughters-in-law. I don't know, I have never seen such, there are, of course, I'm not denying that these things are happening in today's society, but still, there are family. I think the education is the main key to that.
Yes.
If the family is educated, if the girl is educated, the dowry is given with love and affection.
Yeah.
But I have married 2 of my sons. But we
never
and also, did you never find any reference where the boy's family is gifting the daughter-in-law?
Yes, I
because
did.
It's the same these days.
Yes.
The girl's family gives gifts to the boy and their family. The boy's family doesn't give gifts to the family of the bride, but they do give gifts to the bride, and that is also a very important ritual these days.
Yes, that's what I'm saying, because, like I said, most of the women now are educated and they are working, so it's not the same as...
So gifts go from bride to...
Bridegroom's family to the bride.
Yeah.
That
but not
is
the
also
other way around
done socially in a group.
Yeah.
When the bride enters the house, so everybody, all the relatives, they give gifts. Even when the
more
engagement...
like history done, like I was arguing. But and like I say, I'm not really saying it's a Hindu custom, like I said in my paper. And I was in Delhi for 2 months. I talked to people. I collected like newspapers and all that. And every day...
Yeah, but you see, the newspapers these days, they want to sensationalize news. That's what I feel.
That's true.
Not
but,
what is coming in newspapers is the real society. They want to sell their papers. Because in our families or in my relatives, I and even regarding divorce, some of the my girl's family, she is divorced. She is divorced twice. It is a stigma still, but the situation is
changing.
Now, actually, the rules and the laws are much more in favor of women. And some girls are falsely implicating their in-laws.
Yes,
because
that's what
I read.
If
they go and complain, no law can save the boy. And I know of a boy who was unfortunately my student. His whole family is just finished. Because the girl falsely implicated them in the dowry case.
So what did she accuse them of?
Of dowry. Asking for
dowry.
Whether it was not true at all. She also knew and everybody around knew.
But everybody in the boy's family was put in jail, even those who didn't attend the marriage. His sisters were never in, attended the marriage. They were in Bombay. But because if a complaint is lodged with the police, then the girl and her parents say that we are being asked for more dowry, nobody can save them. So the laws now are much more in favor of women in the situation. But you are right that the situation is changing only in the urban areas and the educated circles. And there are cases of bride burning and all that. But still, both the sides have to be looked into.
Yes,
and we hope that the situation changes for the better. Yeah.
Are there any statistics or figures about?
Yes, in my paper, I do have the recent statistics from Delhi, like the Bureau and from the government. But they argue that it's, according to the government, the government statistics are not portraying the real statistics out there. So there are also some statistics from female groups, and they tend to be higher as compared to the government statistics.
Which do you think are accurate?
as a researcher, because I've been there and I've seen women coming in, you know, like even that professor is right, because others would just make up a story, maybe just to get out of the house or to be given back the money. But most cases, women who were coming there were, you know, battered, and you know, so I do believe that in a way, the people from the like Saheli,
they are
and
exaggerating.
All that, in a way, yeah, they may be, because they are women also, and feminists. Because I'm not really a feminist.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just writing
mm-hmm.
on them.
Yeah.
But they are feminists, and I know at times feminists can be a bit
And they
overboard.
Also at times they provoke the girls to lodge a complaint in this rule. And
but
because
I'm writing on marriage exchange, and because the woman is part of the exchange, that's why my paper also is just a little part of my PhD. It's not at all my PhD. Yeah.
Just out of curiosity, I'm more interested in the historical, what we say,
evolution.
Facts and evolution of things, as well as the mythological, as well as practices which were practiced in the olden days as rituals.
Yes.
Did your research come out, did your research much into that aspect of it as well?
Yes, in fact, that's what my research really is interested in, because what I did was I did not only look at the Dharma Shastras, I also look at the epics, you know, just going through everything slowly and trying to see really what was happening. If there was a Swayamvara, for instance, what was the gift? Was like self-choice, there were cases of self-choice, and was the woman given a gift, or did she just you know, go away with the husband without any gift? Because I'm mainly interested in the gift, really. What was there? And in most cases, the girl was the gift. Yes. And that's what I'm arguing, like the girl has always been the gift. But now, when things change with the introduction of money, you know, commission, consumerism and all that, everything is changing.
Off,
Yes.
What about the aspect of the ratio between male and female and the change in the ratios of males to females and females to males over the period of time?
Yeah,
did that have any effect or implications on how a person was or the girl was treated?
That's a very interesting question, because what I did was I also looked into women as they were, like in the past, what was expected of them, and now what is expected of them, and the question of son's preference, why a boy is more important than a girl, because of the religious, you know, performance of what the father is there, or carrying out the name and all that. That has always been there.
Mm.
But recent scholars argue that now dowry tends to take over, you know, precedence on top of the other, like, importance of a son, but dowry tends to be more, you know, taking more weight. And what I was trying to do is I was trying to look at women during the past, and scholars are arguing that the ratio between the boys and the girls. It's like there are more boys than there are girls. And people are saying this is only prevalent, especially in North India. I don't know how true that is. I'm still trying to find out. In North India, because of hypergamy, whereas in South India, because of this cross-cousin marriages, it's not there. And because the daughter can go and get married to a total, you know, stranger, where the marriage is arranged, and she doesn't know, but these people still believe that that in a way contributes to, you know, this unbalanced ratios. And they came up with a table of how many boys, I mean girls per 1,000 boys, and mostly it was the northern states which had less girls. In fact,
female feticide and all that.
Yes, in fact, they said modernity is one contributing factor, because it's easy to just go to the doctor
and
have the baby screened, and then.
Yeah, but what I'm trying to get at is slightly different in this context of dowry becoming from a gift, a super gift, to a dowry situation. Was it due to the ratios of girls becoming more than boys?
There's a theory which is called the marriage squeeze,
mm-hmm.
where the person who they argue it's Rao, I think, yeah, Rao. She argues that there was a point in time where there were more boys than girls. And it goes back to the medieval period where the Muslims came into India. And because of that, they were targeting mainly young girls who were virgins, who were not married. Because they, according to the Quran, they could not touch married women, so they targeted mainly young girls, and these girls, the fathers felt threatened because they needed to be protected, so they had to marry them off very quickly, and that meant a girl at 14 would already be given away. But then there was a problem: there were many girls to be given away, and very few boys to take the girls, and as a result, there was a marriage squeeze. Some people take dowry to that point. Like, that's where it may have started. Because now the boys, because they felt that they were scarce, then they had to be paid more to be able to secure your daughter.
You mentioned that dowry is not purely a Hindu.
Yes, because
it's a practice.
Practice
but,
or custom.
Could it be that it have you looked into other religions where it could have been a practice which came to India?
Yes, in fact, I'm trying to come with a new hypothesis, but I have to prove it. It's a bit tricky because there is no enough material written on it. So I'm like trying to, I'm really scavenging all over the place. And I think, because dahej is not even Sanskrit.
We have the word yotuka.
Yes, dahej is not even Sanskrit, but zahez is Persian. So I'm trying to look into the etymology of the word. I tried to do that, and I consulted one Islamic specialist. Unfortunately, he knows more about Egypt marriage exchange, not medieval India. But he said it may be a very interesting finding.
Mm.
Yes.
I'm of the opinion that dahej is actually more of a Urdu word, then it's
Persian,
Indian word, or Sanskrit or Hindi kind of word, and I think it started from the advent of Muslims.
Well, that's how that's my new hypothesis. I'm trying to prove that, but
and that was the period when parents were
concerned
as you say,
yes.
about
yeah.
the safety of their young daughters.
Mm-hmm.
This quotation that you gave me regarding the incident of the Muslim era when there were more girls than boys and more girls were
married
wanting to be
married
off.
Yeah.
Now, is there
any
specific literature that
There is literature. What I've found out, there is literature about like what happened when the Muslims occupied India, because it is generally believed that dowry started in the. I mean, it is
north,
all the scholars agree that it started in the north,
yeah.
And north is the first place where
invasions
started.
Mm. Yeah.
So I'm trying to reconcile the two. And not only that, it started among the Rajputs. And the Rajputs, by that time, they were the rulers.
Mm.
And the women, because I'm interested also with the women, during that time, their position was threatened. And those who were married, in case their husbands lost during the war, because Hindus, or okay, they were fighters, but they were not as good as the Shiites who occupied India there. Then the women would throw themselves into this jauhar.
Padmini performed the jauhar.
Yes.
Many women joined her.
They kill themselves to avoid humiliation.
Yeah, they would immolate themselves.
Yes, to avoid humiliation from the army if their husbands get killed.
Even my mother, because my parents came from undivided Pakistan, and she said in those days all young women in the family, even married ones, were given a small poison with
to kill them,
so that if anybody just swallow it and jump down into the well. Every house had a well. She says we were always prepared with that poison in hand. So that's the traumatic aspect here.
So fortunately I have consulted with Islamic, because I have to, you know, get the facts right. I've consulted with the Islamic scholar in Oxford, Rappaport, the one who studies Islamic, but he's Jewish. I don't know if you're Joseph.
Rappaport.
Yeah. And he's done a few studies in Egypt, and when he mentions Zahej, it's around the same period, like 7th century. And that's the same period when the Muslims also went to India. So I'm trying to see if I can bring
that
all that.
That would be a fantastic finding
together.
If you could substantiate it.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Very interesting.
Yeah. Going back to the, we say, Vedic and those kind of eras, you mentioned that it was a super gift.
Mm.
Was it actually defined as so in the scriptures, or it is your...
Well, it's more like my coinage, really.
Okay.
But because there are 8 types of marriages, like Professor has already said, there are 8 types of marriages, and depending on which marriage, like Brahma marriage, for instance, what was how the daughter was given, and that in itself, the way they put it, I mean, they don't use super gift, but the way they put it was the girl was given that... you know,
by
position,
the parents,
yes, of being the most important gift. So, like the first 4 marriages,
Brahmin,
which were also part
socially
of the
acceptable.
Upper class. Manu decided, like.
But we have Gandharva, where the girl and the boy can choose themselves.
Yes,
yeah.
But we also have love, where they just eloped together, and you know, we also have also this Virashulka, where the husband had to show that he was powerful, like had to go through a game or to show a skill.
Like Arjuna did the Draupadi.
To show a skill to be able to be given a girl.
Then like Bhishma just dragged Ambika and Ambalika.
And then there's that Rakshasa, and you just grab, and they say it's more for Kshatriyas. Forceful marriage, where they just grab the girl and run away with the girl, and then they are married. They are considered married. And then there's the one where the girl is raped by Chasha, and they were not allowed, they were not recommended, but they were still
they
married.
Were prevalent, that's what they say. But
they
say Sarvesham eva dananam brahma danam visheshyate.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the gift of knowledge that is the highest form of dana.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's also from some of the one of the Smritis.
Mm.
And in the Vedic period, if you are just going up to that period, you must please put somewhere that there was no discrimination between the daughters, and that was the
that's
most egalitarian society.
Yes, that's
absolutely
what I
mean.
Because they say the word Kanya itself is the beloved daughter,
beloved
and they
daughter.
Aspire for young daughters moving around with their... what do you call the wearing something in their feet, and the house is being resonated with those lively things,
and
they're so
even worshipped as
they were
goddesses.
They were very darling daughters of the house.
But also property ownership, they would have their own property at that stage, would
they don't talk of property as such, they don't, because they are not the Shastras actually, but there is whatever we find the position of women is very very exalted. In every act she is participating, she has the decision, she was the seer of the, like that. So that is the most coveted situation.
Things just change more when we get to the
And we do
Dharma
not find we do not find the word bharya. Bharya, I think the usage of the term bharya, when she was to be looked after, she was to be provided,
it's more
that
like
word doesn't occur in the Vedas.
Yeah.
We have Jaya, we have Patni, we have Jani, we have Duhitri, but the word Bharya doesn't occur there. That is also a very important clue.
You get the protection of women's property rights and so on in Jivutavahana's text, which is 11th century, which is a law book in Bengal, which is it's quite late in a way. So I'm wondering if the Muslims brought in the dowry, is there a counterbalance within the Muslim law that protects women's rights as well? So, I mean, like, you often speak to Muslims, they often say that, you know, Muhammad protected women's rights and so on, and
it's
property
very,
rights.
It's very interesting because when you talk to Muslims, they'll tell you there's nothing like dowry in their society.
They have
mehr, and
mehr
they'll just tell you it's mehr, like bride price. They'll tell you that. But this professor, he's written that although it is not allowed or it's not subscribed to or condoned by the Islamic
scriptures,
it was there. But it only appears in his, he looked at divorce books, like when people were divorcing and all that, manuscripts.
Yeah.
Then that's when he found Dahej in the divorce manuscript, not in any other paper. So, but if you talk to an ordinary Muslim, they'll kill you. They'll say that's a Hindu thing, you know, they'll just tell you that. But that's what I'm trying to.
So, were the girls given their money back in a divorce situation?
Yeah.
They were.
That's what the mihr means. That's what the mihr means.
So, in that case, then it's more like it's bride price. Mm. I mean, the Muslims will tell you, no, we give the girls presents from there. We don't have the husband giving, you know, presents. And then there's this question of Varadakshina.
Yeah.
I'm also trying to look more into that. If the father of the bride, for instance, could give his son-in-law just a small present of saying thank you for, you know, taking my daughter, but it's not a payment.
Mm.
And people later, I think, they also use that to say it's bride, it's dowry, and they say, I call it groom price now, because the way dowry is, it's more like a groom price really than a bride price, the price for the woman. So I don't. I'll look at that. It's a very unresearched area, and because already people have this, like, Islam equals mehri, Hindu equals dahej, and my paper is going to change that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, also, why did it catch on then? If it originally a sort of Islamic custom, why did it catch on?
Yes. One argument that I'm putting forward is, it started amongst the upper class, they say, like, that's the general consensus by all the Indian scholars. And because it may be right that it started among the upper class, because upper class were known for giving their daughters a lot of presence. And I'm arguing that because of, I think this was more like an occupation. So there was a bit of assimilation happening. And I don't think there was any adaptation. I don't think the Muslims adapted to the Hindu style because customs, because otherwise they would have converted to Hinduism, but they never did. They still kept their religion. But in a way, they forced Hindus to convert to their religion.
Mm.
So I'm arguing that maybe during the process of, you know, coercion and conversion, which was by the sword, people, when they married, because they ended up marrying Hindus, and because it was a master, it wasn't an equal relation, it was a master-servant relationship, the upper class still gave their daughters the present. And maybe the Muslims took that to get more. I mean, used that opportunity of the upper class already giving, they used that to coerce even more present because they were in power.
Mm.
They were like the rulers then.
Mm.
It's just the things I'm really like trying to dig deep into it and trying to find out if I can get there.
Very interesting.
Very interesting, yeah. I suppose in Britain we have a sort of equivalent of a dowry, and the bride's parents pay for the wedding usually. So I guess that's
also, I was thinking just the same thing, that you get given away. I've got a friend who's never got married. She's my age. She said, "You know, I will never get married because," she said, "I don't want to walk down the aisle and have my father give me away."
Yes.
And I sort of never thought about it, but you do, it's actually exactly the same thing. Some sense that the dad is giving away his daughter.
The daughter, yes.
And
so it's women as economic property, isn't it? It's an exchange value
in
or
a
something.
Way, yeah.
But I think
that's
a modern way of viewing
this.
It. I don't think it would have been seen negatively. I think the interesting thing is that it clearly is seen negatively now,
and
is negative in a way that it... Would it be seen negatively in tradition? I mean, it's just like when you get married, you don't see it as negative when your father gives you... You know, you just don't... You don't see it in those terms.
No.
Something's changed. Then.
And even as she says that the rich people, if your parents can afford,
they will
celebration will involve some gifts.
Yeah.
Mm. So if they are not forced to give gifts, and if there is no problem, I think it's a matter of rejoicing and celebrating.
Mm.
Mm. And the girl gets equally so many
gifts
in wedding from the boy's side.
Mm.
In some of the families in North India, I know that they weigh the money.
Mm.
Whatever money is being paid by the daughter's side, they will see that the same amount of jewelry is given to their daughter by the bride's.
That's interesting. So it's reciprocal.
Agrawal families like that.
Yeah, it's
50-50,
which is.
So they ensure that this amount of jewelry should be given to their daughter.
Mm.
Also, I think one needs to look at the diversity
in India.
Yes.
And
I think each community has different practices.
Yeah. Yes, in fact, my setting is North India.
Okay.
I mean, for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
But I'm mainly covering, you know, the Sindh area, like so-called Punjab and all.
Rajasthan.
Because that's the area that really,
really has
got the highest prevalence of dowry deaths.
Is it?
Yes. And daughter sons
ratio,
which is very high.
Mm. Just one more thing was in the context of dowry becoming a problem and possibly oriented to greed. Could it have been influenced by the Western thought processes in the context that materialism actually came to India from the West, in a way.
Yes.
Would that have any effect on the...
In fact, in my literature review, I try to define dowry in general, and I look at all the possible definitions that have been used, like for instance, status, like dowry status, groom price, dowry versus bride price, and all that. And and then I have what I call theories of dowry, like how dowry might have come about. And one of them, yes, is modernization or British, creating what Oldenburg calls a masculine society, where the men had to do, he says, had to do all the work and the women were rendered hopeless and all that. And that's why the men had to be expensive in the long run. So she points that, she also points to British coming with and then creating this class, this white collar jobs, and every family or parent wants their daughter, they'll rather prefer their daughter to be married to someone who's educated than go and work in the fields all day long, you know, in the village. So in a way, the British bringing in money has also fueled the problem, which was already there. There were undercurrents all the time, but
yeah.
It's like now it's boiling over. The pot is boiling over here.
Well, thank you very much. That's a very interesting research and important work, really. If you can discover that link with the Muslim influx into India, that'd be very interesting indeed. So, thank you for coming all the way from Canterbury to share your research with us.
My pleasure. Mm.
Thank
you for coming.
Thank you.
Very good work.
Turn this off.
You must have seen the book by Altaker.
Yes. Yes, I have a copy.
Yeah. And I'll see Monier Williams for the word Yautuka.
Oh,
yes, that's a good idea.
Because for the age we have this word Yautuka.
Absolutely. Just try to work it out.
How often do you all update it on the web?
Oh, Shaunaka does all that.
Oh, is it?
Yes,
okay.
Yes. It's quite often, I think.
Interesting.
So this should be up fairly soon.
All right, yeah, that's good.
If I can work out how to turn it off. Do you understand these things?
No.
Yeah.
It must be, yeah.
The button.
Hold.
They also have this tilak also.
Tilak is just like, that is the engagement ceremony.
But there's some people also
tilak is this, we call it tika in North India, that is done at the time of engagement.
So you can just download these off the internet, that's a good idea.
Yes.
So we'll be able to just see you on the
internet. You will be able to, yes.
Very good.
Is it possible? How far into your PhD are you? When do you, are you likely to complete this?
July.
It's
July.
Great.
Would it be possible to get your final dissertation complete?